Good afternoon. If we look around us, we can see an amazing and wonderful world. The Apostle Paul saw the same world when he looked around him, and so did the first century believers in Rome. And in Paul's letter to the Romans, in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, he talks about what we think about God when we look around us. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 says, "The invisible things of him, God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." They there being those people who wish to believe that there is no God. So Paul says that by looking around at the things that have been created, by looking at the things that have been made, we can see the invisible things of God. The invisible things of God, he says, are his eternal power and Godhead. In other words, that there is a God, that God who claims to be God, really is God, and that he is the one who has the power and did create all things. He says the proof is in everything that is around us. And he goes on to describe how that if you drop this belief from your consciousness, then there is no restraint. And if mankind in general drops this belief, then there is no restraint. Society has no restraint. Because if you don't believe the things that God commands, then there is no reason why anything should be wrong, except if you choose for it to be wrong and you decide that it is wrong. There is no absolute law of right and wrong once you lose God. And he goes on to describe what happens to society. He says, verse 21, when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations. Their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. That's what happens. And then you find something else to worship, whether that's physical objects, as some still do, and people very much did in times past, worshipping physical idols, or whether it's worship of ourselves or of our society or something that we find we need to believe in. So he says that the belief in God is an important thing, and that we can see evidence for God. Now, there's always the argument of evolution versus creation. Now we can try and show that we can try and prove creation, or we can prove that the Bible is true, and then we can just go back to the beginning of the Bible and read the words, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." Now, if we can once convince ourselves that the Bible is true and trust it, that everything it says is true, then we have to believe that when it says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," and goes on to describe how that over 1 week God created everything upon the earth, then we have to accept that as fact as well. So God, he is presented to us here as a powerful God. Genesis chapter 1, the very beginning of the Bible, the first fact that the Bible gives us is God is powerful. God made everything. If God made everything, then he must have been there before he made it, to have been able to make it. So if in the beginning, whatever the beginning was, God created the heavens and the earth, in other words, the universe, God must have already been there before the beginning, which presents us with something of a problem, something that seems to us impossible. As with all these things that are difficult for us to understand, the Bible does deal with these. Psalm 90 says, "Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God." So that describes God as being from everlasting to everlasting. So despite the fact that we can't understand it, we cannot get our minds around infinity. Even numerical infinity, as a mathematical principle, mathematicians struggle with the concept, and in talking about maths, they often talk about things approaching infinity, because infinity isn't a concept that we can easily deal with. But God goes back in time infinitely and forward in time infinitely. However we understand that, or however we completely fail to understand that, that is the fact that the Bible presents us with. He always was, he always will be. There never was a time when there was no God, and there never will be a time when there was no God. Our first hymn we had was Immortal, Invisible, God Only Wise. And the words of that hymn describe what God is like in these terms. We've seen that he's a powerful God, that he's an eternal God. He's an invisible God. See, that where we started in Romans chapter 1, it talks about the invisible things. And so it goes on to say that those invisible things of God are his eternal power and Godhead. So that God himself is invisible. None of us have seen him. And this is probably why people, certainly in old times, were so ready to worship an idol, something that they could actually see, something tangible. That's why mankind generally is so willing to put his trust in what he can see, what he can conceive, even if that lets him down. You know, whether it might be in his possessions or his wealth or politicians, whatever we put our trust in, they let us down all the time. And yet we have a tendency to trust them because we can see them. We can see the obvious evidence of them. And God, we cannot see. We can only tell he's there by, as Paul tells the Romans, by looking around us and seeing the things he's made and recognising that those things must have been designed and built by an incredibly amazing and intelligent designer and builder. Writing to Timothy, Paul refers to him as the King, eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, which of course is where the words of that hymn come from. And he says, because he is eternal, immortal, invisible, and only wise, he says, to him be glory and honour forever and ever. Let's go back to Exodus. We're going to look at the chapter before the one we read together, Exodus chapter 33. God explains to Moses why no one can see him. Exodus 33, verse 20. God talking to Moses says, through an angel, he says, thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. In other words, if you see me, you'll die. Verse 21, and the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, thou shalt stand upon a rock, and it shall come to pass while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a clift of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away my hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. Now if you think about God, just try and think about him in some kind of scientific terms, that anything or anyone powerful enough to have created the whole universe clearly is an incredible force, even aside from his intelligence, aside from his beneficence, any of that kind of thing, just in physical terms, a power powerful enough to create everything around us is clearly a fearful power, and something presumably he cannot come face to face with mankind. Now, if you imagine if the sun itself, and God created the sun, so he's far more powerful in physical terms than the sun, if the sun itself was to pass by us, well, it'd burn us up long, and the whole earth up long before it came anywhere near us. I was talking to somebody recently who was explaining the relationship, and if the earth was the size of a marble, the sun would be about this big. And if the earth was on the same scale, if the earth was about the size of a marble, the sun would be about one football pitch away. Okay, so the idea of God actually coming and passing right by Moses is a terrible thing to think about. So God says that Moses cannot see him. He's invisible because he hides himself, because he chooses to hide himself for our sakes, for our protection. However, despite not being seen, he is there. He is all around. His presence is felt in every aspect of life. Psalm 139. David talks about the idea that God is there. That we can't get away from him. He's always there. Psalm 139 and verse 7 says, "Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the utmost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me." Now, surely God can't see us in absolute pitch black darkness. He says, "Even the night shall be light about me. The darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. Darkness and light are both alike to thee." There's no difference. God can see, because he doesn't see in the same way that we see by allowing light waves to enter our eyes and interact with our retina. God perceives because he knows everything, because it's all part of what he's made. He knows. We read elsewhere that the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. So wherever we go, he sees us. He sees what we do. He hears what we say. He sees what we need and is on hand to give it to us. And because he is everywhere and he sees everything, he knows everything. He knows all about us. And that's the first part of this same psalm. David says, "Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off." He says, verse 4, "There is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether." He knows what we're going to say before we've said it. That's when a word is in our tongue, before we've said it. "Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me." And then he goes on to say, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it." And that's the position that every human being finds themselves in if they try and comprehend God. It's too wonderful for us. We can't fully understand it. We have to accept what God says about himself, that he does know. He knows every time we stand up, every time we sit down. He knows what we're thinking, wherever we are, whether we consider ourselves to be a long way from him or whatever. He knows what we're thinking. Jesus says that even the very hairs of our head are numbered. Not that God has particular interest in how many hairs any one of us has left on our head at any time, but he has the power to know that fact. Jonah tried to flee from God because he didn't want to obey what God had commanded him to do. He didn't want to preach where he was asked to preach. So Jonah thought he would escape and run away. God knew exactly where he was. He knew why he'd run away. And God brings events to bear to bring Jonah back round to accepting that he has to do what God wants. Being thrown into the sea, being eaten by the fish, being brought back to land and still being alive. He couldn't escape the fact that God knew what was going on in his mind. And God knew exactly how to persuade Jonah to do what he'd been asked to do in the first place. Again, Jesus says, "There is nothing hid that shall not be known." But all of that, describing God, that shows us that God is an amazing and powerful being, the creator of heaven and earth. It tells us a lot about what God is like, but it's like describing what a person looks like. It's like they're describing somebody by their age, their hair colour, their height, etc. We really need to know what he's like. Because if, as Paul said to the Romans, that having convinced ourselves that there is a God and that he did create everything and that therefore he knows everything and sees everything and is in control of everything, recognizing that we are actually just part of his grand master plan, and that we're just a little jigsaw piece in his grand scheme of things. That being the case, Paul says, you're without excuse for not getting to know him. So it's no good just knowing what he's like as a being. We need to know what he's like as a person. So that's where we come to think about our subject, really, the personality of God. If I introduce you to somebody, there's no point trying to get you only to recognize them. If you really want to know them, you have to find out what their likes, their dislikes, their intentions, their motivation, their character. You have to find out all sorts of aspects about them. So that's what the Bible does for us. As well as presenting to us this great and powerful God, it bit by bit, stage by stage, throughout the pages, from beginning to end, reveals to us what God is like and what God wants from us, how he wants to get to know us and for us to get to know him. Let's go back to Exodus again, and we'll start with Moses. If I say the name of somebody that you would all know, you would instantly identify that name with everything you know about that person. Say somebody famous. And so it is with God, that he tells us his name and he explains to us what he's like, so that every time that name is mentioned, we instantly think of all those things about God, what he's like. And so he begins to talk to Moses when he wants to send Moses into Egypt to gather his people of Israel out of Egypt and to bring them to the promised land. And so he tells Moses, go and say to Pharaoh, let my people go. And he tells Moses also to go to the children of Israel who are slaves in Egypt to accept that God has sent him, Moses, to bring them out. So Moses comes up with a problem, verse 13. Moses said unto God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel and shall say unto them, the God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? It's all very well saying, a God, who I'm claiming is the God of your forebears, a God has asked you to come out of this land and is going to rescue you from your slavery. I'll say, well, how do we know? What's his name? How do we know that you're not just somebody who's going to get us into trouble with our taskmasters? Prove yourself, Moses. Prove that you are actually sent from the God of our fathers. So it's understandable that Moses wants to know who to say he's a messenger for. And so God replies to him in verse 14. God said to Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. Now, in Hebrew that the Old Testament is written in, the tenses don't match. So we don't have exactly like we have a past tense, a present tense, a future tense, a conditional tense, and all the other more complicated ones like the gerund and so on. It doesn't have quite that same structure. This is more of a continual sense. So when it says I am, it more means that I was, am, and will be. It's a kind of eternal tense, if you like. It is used as a future tense. So the nearest we could probably get without saying the whole long phrase of I am, what I was, am, and will be, who I was, am, and will be. The nearest we could get really would be I will be. It has more of a future aspect. But it also, like I say, has this aspect of going right back, infinitely far back, which confirms what we already know about God, that he's from everlasting to everlasting. So he says to Moses, I will be who I will be, which seems a fairly obvious and pointless statement on the face of it. That's the name that God calls himself. Now it's in the first person, so God says, I will be. But then when he talks to Moses, he says, verse 15, God said moreover to Moses, this is what you say to the children of Israel. Okay, so I've told you who I am. This is what I want you to say to the children of Israel. Say, the Lord God of your fathers, or Yahweh God of your fathers, which means he shall be. So they put it in the third person, so talking about God, he shall be. The God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. So it's an eternal name. It's something that goes on forever. And it's something, it's his memorial. It's how they're to identify God. It's what they're to know him by, he says. This is how I want you to remember me. I'm not just any God. I am he who will be, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, your fathers. I am this specific God, and this is how I want you to remember me, and remember that I am your God, and this is what I'm like. So that's the name he gives for mankind to use to address him by. Now let's come on a bit further in Exodus. We come to chapter 33 again, where we were earlier. And in chapter 33, the reason that we were talking about God passing before Moses and hiding himself so that Moses wasn't destroyed, the reason that was happening was because Moses had asked to see God's glory, to prove that he wanted proof, physical proof, that this was the great powerful God, that he did actually have power to save them from the Egyptians and to bring them into their promised land. He wanted more proof. He wanted to know God better. He wanted to see what God was really like. So Moses is expecting primarily to see some great show of power and some great display. In actual fact, they'd seen something of this already, because they'd seen the earthquakes and the fire and so on, the evidence of God's power amongst them. But Moses here seems to want to know more about God. So he has to see God's glory. Now God then goes on straight away to explain that his glory isn't just about a show of power. God's glory is really about what he's like. So verse 18 of Exodus chapter 33, Moses says to God, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. And look what God does. He doesn't say, I will make my glory pass in front of you, which he did do, of course. The brightness and the light and the burning, this is what Moses saw, although he was covered and he only saw the fading glow of it as the manifestation of God passed by. God says, Moses says, show me thy glory. Verse 19, God says, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of he who shall be before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. Ah, now look, he's using the name, he's using his name again that he told Moses in chapter 3. I will be who I will be. But he's extending it. He's saying that actually, even though that seems obvious, that I will be who I will be, of course he will be who he will be. What will be. But now he's adding something in between and saying, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. So these characteristics of grace and mercy, of God's goodness, are being added into this now. So that he will always be gracious. It's a promise tied up in his name. So, God had threatened to destroy Israel because they'd worshipped the golden calf. And Moses had pleaded for them. And so then God says to Moses, you've pleaded with me to save the people and not to kill them all for turning away from me. And so that's when he says, I will be gracious and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And then he begins to explain to Moses what he's like. Now, he said, I will be. So now he's explaining what he will be, gracious and merciful. But he continues, doesn't he? As we read in those last few verses, there can no man see me and live, and he will pass by and cover Moses. So Moses, in the next chapter then, makes preparations and gets up early in the morning, makes his preparations, does as God commanded, goes up to the top of the Mount Sinai. Verse 2. God says, be ready in the morning and come up in the morning unto Mount Sinai and present thyself there to me in the top of the mount. No man shall come up with thee, neither let any man be seen throughout all the mount, neither let the flocks nor herds feed before that mount. So Moses does what God said. And in verse 5, while Moses is on the top of the mountain, the Lord, Yahweh, he who shall be, descended in the cloud and stood with him there. So God, probably the angel of God, carrying all of God's power and authority, came and stood before Moses and proclaimed his name and taught Moses about God's name. Verse 6, and the Lord, he who shall be, passed by before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, God, he shall be mighty ones, it literally means. So, first of all, we see that he will be mighty ones. He will be power. So, first and foremost, God is this great, powerful, terrible God who made everything. But he doesn't leave it there. He says he shall be mighty ones. And then he says, merciful and gracious, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression and sin, that will be by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, upon the children's children, to the third and fourth generation. So he explains what he's like. Firstly, he shall be power. But above that, he is all these other things. When I used to work in an office and have regular annual appraisals of your skills and your abilities and so on, they would assess all your technical, in an IT department, obviously they're very much interested in assessing your technical abilities each year and how well you handle things and how good you are at your actual job. Then they also had a whole thing which they called soft skills. And soft skills were your ability to cope with other people, your ability to diffuse difficult situations, your ability to get on with people generally. And I would say that these things that God is presenting to us here, after his power, his technical ability to create worlds,